going to lay down my heavy load.
Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we'll be talking about faith and music. We'll learn about Sister Rosetta Tharpe, one of the first great recording stars of gospel music.
These Pentecostal churches had a big influence on early rock and roll and this just excitement and fervor and filling with the Spirit.
And we'll hear about the story behind a song that became an American icon.
Amazing Grace would have spoke to their desire for an experience of freedom, of one day seeing God face to face, of being with Him for all of eternity, and no longer subjected to the type of cruel treatment they experienced during slavery.
And we'll catch up with photographer Roger May, whose project Glory depicts images of Pentecostal-style revivals in Kentucky and West Virginia.
I think there's something to be said about perseverance and being faithful to what you feel like you're called to do.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. That's Sister Rosetta Tharpe. She was a singer, songwriter, and guitarist who became popular in the 30s and 40s. In fact, she became the first superstar of gospel music. Along with her powerful, passionate voice, her rhythmic style and charisma captivated an entire generation of rock and rollers. There's Rosetta Tharpe singing Amazing Grace, an old American hymn with a complex history. Later in the show, we'll find out how the song moved from the church into mainstream America, and we'll learn more about a project depicting current Pentecostal-style tent revivals. But first, she's often called the godmother of rock and roll. Sarah McConnell spoke with a music historian about Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Not many of us have heard of her, but Sister Rosetta Tharpe was a major influence on Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard, and Johnny Cash. In fact, before he died, Johnny Cash called Tharpe his favorite singer. Chris Kajornis is a professor of music at Longwood University and teaches a course on the history of rock and roll. Chris, tell me about Sister Rosetta Tharpe and where she came from.
Well, she was born in 1915 in Cotton Plant, Arkansas. Both of her parents were amateur instrumentalists, and their life really centered around the church.
Her mother was a strong woman with no fear. She was what they call a stomp-down Christian.
Yeah, she played guitar and tambourine and would even go and just sit out on the steps and play and try to bring people to Jesus.
So, Rosetta Bell, what was she like during this period of her early, early upbringing in Arkansas? Was she singing at age 2, 3, 4?
Yeah, and there's great stories of her being lifted up on the piano and singing before the congregation. It's pretty clear that she was playing the guitar from about the age 4.
So her mother eventually leaves Arkansas and moves to Chicago with Rosie.
She would have been 6, and she was obviously exposed to this very emotive Pentecostal music. Pentecostal music was exciting. It was fervent. There were no limits. They were one of the first churches to have live instruments. And so she was soaking all of this up. I think you hear it on this 1960 recording of Sit Down, where she was playing the solid body electric guitar, and you just feel this energy. You can hear her stomping her foot, and you can just imagine everyone jumping up and stomping with her. This is the church where people would end up speaking in tongues and rolling in the aisle, and I think we feel this urge to do that as well when we hear this.
Sit down. Sit down. I can't sit down. Go away. Don't bother me. I can't sit down. I feel so happy and I can't sit down. Sit down. No, I can't sit down. Sit down. No, no, I can't sit down. No, 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 I can't sit down. I feel so happy and I can't sit down. Who's that yonder dressed in white? I
That is electrifying.
She's a one-woman powerhouse. To see video of her brings it home, too. It's just so amazing to see this woman. And there weren't videos made until the 60s, but she's in, you know, full dress all the way down to the collar to cuffs and just up there ripping it up.
That is her playing the electric guitar?
That is.
Was she religious herself, like her mother was?
That's always a tough question, because there's certainly things that she did that would not fit with what you would think of as a religious person.
But she was gaining in the 20s almost wild popularity with the African-American gospel church-going audience.
Yes, and then as the 20s give way to the 30s, she ends up in Miami, and you have one of the strangest scenes we can imagine, where she's performing at a temple in Miami, and they begin broadcasting this on the radio. And so now all of a sudden, people outside of the Black Pentecostal community are hearing Sister Rosetta Tharpe and start coming to the temple. You get this very bizarre scene where you have white listeners, you have Jewish listeners that are packing the balcony while the congregants are down on the floor and everyone is enjoying this music. And we can hear that excitement that was generated. When we listen to Didn't It Rain, this is one of the really wonderful duets that she would record a little bit later on with Marie Knight. And you can imagine hearing this on the radio and going, I want to be where that is.
I can imagine hearing that on the radio for the first time. It's electrifying.
Absolutely. And I think that when we look at the explosion of rock and roll and all the excitement that came with this hot music, these Pentecostal churches had a big influence on early rock and roll, and this just excitement and fervor and filling with the Spirit. Women swooning and passing out when they see an Elvis Presley or a Beatles and they're hearing this music relates much more closely to what you would see at a Pentecostal service than what you would see at, say, a blues club. So at a certain point, Rosetta Tharpe decided to go to New York and will actually start performing at the Cotton Club. And she was still performing a lot of her gospel material, but she was also starting to experiment with integrating secular music. This was a shock to the fans that had come up knowing her as the singing evangelist. She was taking gospel songs and putting a twist on them, which may or may not be sacred anymore. If we listen to this recording of Rock Me, which she did with the Lucky Millinder Orchestra, we hear that. First, let's listen to a more church-oriented version of this by the Salad Jubilee Singers. And so this is wonderful song by Thomas Dorsey about being sheltered and protected by the Lord in your times of trouble. Now, Sister Rosetta would take this, and the way, the inflection that she put on the term rock me and the way she rolled the R's was quite shocking at the time and suggested something much more worldly than this sort of protective spirit.
You brighter, you make my burden lighter. do good wherever I can. Oh, let thou praise and thrill me. Thou loving kindness fill me. Then you hold me. Hold me in the hollow of thy hand. You hide me in thy bosom. Tell the storm of life is over. Oh, rock me.
Oh,
God. Right. And, you know, here she is. She's doing the sacred material, but there's something else going on here. And on top of that, she was recording purely secular songs, songs she recorded with the Lucky Millinder Orchestra, Tall Skinny Papa. There's no double interpretation of this that has anything to do with sacred and secular.
Her popularity did soar during this period, though.
It did. This was the period where she would have a publishing contract with Irving Mills. This is when she would start recording for Decca Records, which was unheard of to have anyone singing anything like gospel on Decca. They had experimented briefly with Mahalia Jackson, but had no success. So she was at the height of her popularity during this period. In 1944, she would record what would be her most lasting sort of masterpiece, and this is Strange Things Are Happening Every Day. This was with the Sam Price Trio, and one of the interesting things about this recording is Sam Price is playing boogie-woogie piano on this. Price himself was a little bit hesitant to do this on a spiritual record, but again, Sister Tharp said, hey, if it's in praise, it's all good.
Church people say they are in this holy way. There are strange things happening every day. On that last great judgment day, when they drive them all away, there are strange things happening every day. Every day.
Every day.
Every day.
And this record in particular would really predict a lot of the things that became the rock and roll revolution in the 1950s.
How so?
Well, I think rhythmically you hear it. It has a different feel than the swing that we heard of Rock Me. It has something that's more visceral and more pushing forward, a lot of that coming out of the piano. This record in particular became extremely popular in Memphis in the 50s, thanks to Dewey Phillips, who was a white DJ who is sort of credited as the person who broke Elvis regionally. Johnny Cash, in his Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction speech, said that was his favorite singer as a child, was Rosetta Tharpe.
Really?
Yeah.
And he would have heard this on the radio.
Right. He would have heard this on the radio and also on the records. Records were making the rounds, and her popularity extended beyond just black audiences. One of the most interesting stories about this particular song and Rosetta at this time was when she was playing in Macon, Georgia, and there was a young man who was working in the theater there. He was waiting in the wings to catch her attention and actually started singing this song. She said, well, that's wonderful, and invited this 12-year-old boy to come on stage and sing with her. And that was actually Little Richard.
No.
Yeah.
That's
so
great.
She gave Little Richard his first gig, and he has said that was his favorite singer at the time as well. Some of her best material came in 1946 when she started recording with the singer Marie Knight. Their music is so dynamic and playful and exciting, and is probably, by my estimation, some of the greatest music recorded during this period of time. This particular song, Up Above My Head, really illustrates the way they're able to feed each off of each other and create something extremely powerful.
Up above my head.
Up above my head.
I hear music in the air.
I hear music in the air.
Now up above my head.
Up above my head.
You know
head.
I hear music in the air.
I hear music in the air.
Up above my head.
Up above my head.
I hear music in the air.
I hear music in the air.
And I really do believe.
Yes, I really do believe that
there's a heaven somewhere. Heaven somewhere. Up above my head.
Up above my head.
I see trouble in the air.
I see trouble in the air.
Up above my head.
Up above my head.
I see trouble in the air.
I see trouble in the air.
Up above my head.
Up above my head.
great. Where does she really belong in the history of rock and roll? Did she inspire rock and roll, or was she just a really terrific singer who helped influence guys?
Well, that's an interesting question. And there were people that were hearing this music and being inspired by it and bringing it into what they were doing. One of the things that's thought of as being very important about rock and roll is that it was biracial music, and it was music that challenged the racial status quo of the time. Well, Sister Rosetta Tharpe had toured the South with the Jordanaires. So here is this black woman leading a band with white background singers in the middle of the segregated South, and this is in the 1940s. The Jordanaires were actually very popular with Elvis Presley, and when he went to RCA, that was the group he handpicked to back him. So when we hear something like Hound Dog, those background vocals are the same group that were touring with Rosetta Tharpe.
Oh my gosh, those are the Jordanaires?
Absolutely, yeah. And Gail Wald, who wrote this wonderful book on Rosetta Tharpe, would have interviews with them later, and they talked about Elvis really admiring Rosetta Tharpe, not just as a guitar player, but specifically as a singer, and really being inspired by her music. As we look at this more and more, it's time to reevaluate where we put her in this sort of history of rock and roll. The Million Dollar Quartet, the very famous photo taken in Sun Studios with Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis Presley and Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash, all of them were influenced by Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
People fighting one another, I think they're doing swell.
That was music historian Chris Cajorns speaking with Sarah McConnell, host of the show With Good Reason. That interview was originally recorded in 2013. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear the story behind Amazing Grace. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound. It sure is to me. That's Sister Rosetta Tharpe singing the old gospel hymn. You'll hear her again in our next segment. You see, Amazing Grace is an old American hymn that everybody recognizes. It's a song that even moves people who have no feeling for the spiritual and religious. But its origins are unexpected and complicated. Trey Kay has the story.
In 1748, a slave ship was heading back to England from Charleston, South Carolina, after having discharged its cargo of African natives. They were getting closer to home, just off the coast of Donegal, Ireland, when bam! The ship gets battered by a violent storm. The boards of the hull are popping off, and water is gushing into the hold. It seems certain that the boat is going to go down. The captain and the crew work frantically to patch the leak. The captain orders a man named John Newton onto the deck to steer the vessel.
And he has to strap himself to the helm to avoid, you know, sliding down the deck.
That's Steve Turner, author of Amazing Grace, the story of America's most beloved song.
And it's at that point that he becomes a Christian. He vows that if his life is saved, that he's going to pursue this relationship with God.
Miraculously, the ship survives the storm. Newton keeps his word and devotes the rest of his life to the Christian faith. Now, this is a famous story, and it's usually spun into some triumphant, I've seen the light moment. The story goes that Newton, who had worked in the slave trade for years, at that moment renounced slavery. But did Newton really have a conversion?
He didn't leave the slave trade immediately. In fact, he went back to Liverpool and became the captain of a ship for the first time, and he did three voyages as a captain of a slave ship.
Newton would captain slave ships for another 14 years. During this time, he was devout to his Christian practice, but he never saw his work in the slave trade as being at odds with his religion. After health problems drove him ashore for good, he eventually made his way into the Anglican clergy. Newton became the priest of a small chapel in the English town of Olney. Over time, he began to write hymns to accompany his sermons. On New Year's Day, 1773, he introduced his congregation to a hymn that was inspired in part by his near-death experience at sea. It's called Faith's Review and Expectation, but it's come to be known by its opening phrase.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
That's Deborah Carlton Loftus, executive director of the Hymn Society of the United States and Canada.
Well, it wouldn't have been to the tune that we all recognize as associated with Amazing Grace.
Newton didn't write the tune that we know. Actually, he didn't write any tunes for his hymns. He wrote his verses in a common meter that could be sung to many different melodies.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
It's often said that Amazing Grace was written by an abolitionist. But John Newton wasn't an abolitionist when he wrote it. He never spoke of slavery from the pulpit. And it wasn't until 1788, 15 years after he wrote the hymn, that Newton finally spoke out against slavery, publishing an anti-slavery pamphlet, and becoming, finally, an outspoken abolitionist. But at the time, having written Amazing Grace wasn't his claim to fame.
Was Amazing Grace a popular hymn in England at the time that John Newton wrote it?
Actually not. It was not very well known, not considered in England to be one of his finest hymns. But it came over to the United States and picked up some usage and popularity in the revival meetings of the Second Great Awakening.
The Second Great Awakening was a Protestant revival movement that began around 1790 and continued into the late 1850s. It started in western New York and moved down through the Ohio Valley into Kentucky and Tennessee. Folks would travel in covered wagons from far away to camp for a couple of weeks, worshiping with preachers from various denominations.
Thousands of people would come together for these outdoor revival meetings.
Singing was a big part of these meetings.
There were choruses and refrains that people could learn quickly.
At the time, America had several schools that had the purpose of training teachers to help church congregations engage in the beautiful harmonic singing of sacred words. Enthusiastic, even ecstatic singing was the hallmark of these large camp revival gatherings. Music scholars believe Amazing Grace was sung at these revivals to many different tunes.
So far, 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 so.
William Walker was a singing teacher in South Carolina who published a songbook called Southern Harmony in 1847. That's the first documented instance when Newton's words were set to a tune called New Britain. Deborah Loftus says that back in the heyday of the revival meetings, it wasn't only whites attending.
We have documented that both free black persons and white people were together for these outdoor revivals, and there was a lot of interchange of musical styles.
These singing styles were passed on through the generations in African-American families. We're hearing the singing of a family who are descendants of slaves that were featured in the 1990 Bill Moyers documentary about Amazing Grace.
tiptoe and stare. I have already taken.
Well, I think the song would have had a great attraction for the African slaves that were in chattel slavery, in bondage, in cruel, horrific oppression.
That's Reverend Matthew J. Watts, pastor of the Grace Bible Church in Charleston, West Virginia.
Amazing Grace would have spoke to their desire for an experience of freedom, of one day seeing God face to face, of being with him for all of eternity, and no longer subjected to the type of cruel treatment they experienced during slavery.
When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining.
Pastor Watts is singing a verse that today is often included in performances of Amazing Grace, but it's not something that was written by John Newton. That's because Camp Revival music leaders tended to do a bit of mashing up of hymns, singing them to different tunes, lifting verses from one hymn and singing them in another. That's what happened with Amazing Grace. In 1852, some of the verses written by Newton, along with the When We've Been There 10,000 Years verse, appeared in the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin. Tom sings these Amazing Grace verses in his darkest hour. Author Harriet Beecher Stowe was the daughter and sister of revival preachers, and she may have heard Amazing Grace sung this way at a revival meeting. Some think her novel may have played a role in shaping how we sing Amazing Grace today.
So it's a moment of fusion between traditional, you might say, high society, white culture, and popular culture, black culture, revival, evangelical culture.
Jim Basker teaches English and history at Barnard College, and he's the editor of Amazing Grace, an anthology of poems about slavery. He says Stowe had met with runaway slaves, and she read slave narratives, and that she knew the song would resonate with African Americans.
So when she reached into that scene, and this is a moment of fusion between whites and blacks, it's a white woman author creating one of the most memorable black characters in all of 19th century literature, she reached for what would be the paradigmatic song from his soul that he might sing on his deathbed, and it's Amazing Grace.
The first recording of Amazing Grace was in 1922 by a group known as the Original Sacred Harp Choir. Around this time, the hymn was adopted as a folk song, and musicologist John Lomax and his son Alan were famous for capturing authentic folk performances, like this 1935 recording of Kentucky folk singer Aunt Molly Jackson. In the 1920s and 30s, there were the beginnings of a recording industry catering to the demand for songs appealing to a religious black audience. That's Reverend J.M. Gates' recording of Amazing Grace, which sold thousands of copies. And throughout the century, all of the great gospel singers would record the song, like Sister Rosetta Tharpe. During the Civil Rights era, activist Fannie Lou Hamer would lead protesters to sing songs like Amazing Grace, helping to define racial equality as a moral and religious pursuit. By the 1960s, white folk singers were finding their way to Amazing Grace, like Arlo Guthrie, who sang the song at Woodstock.
I once was lost, but now I'm found.
But Guthrie's version was not nearly as popular as one by another white artist who would soon follow.
My name is Judy Collins.
In 1969, Judy Collins was attending what she calls an encounter group when things got really contentious. Collins' record producer happened to be there.
And he said, you know, people are really at each other's throats. Isn't there anything you could do to settle them down? Why don't you sing something? And my grandmother was a church-going Methodist, and she had taught me Amazing Grace when I was a little girl. So I sang Amazing Grace. It was one of the few songs that I knew that I figured everybody would know something of, and they all sang, and it did settle everybody down.
The next day, that same producer called and said, we have to record that song.
So I said, well, let's go into a church somewhere. And so we went up to the campus of Columbia University, and we went into the chapel. It's called St. Paul's. It's a gorgeous chapel, and we all got together and we recorded Amazing Grace.
'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear.
Elektra Records released Collins' recording of Amazing Grace on her 1970 Wales and Nightingales album.
My record company was flabbergasted. They didn't know what hit them.
The album went gold, and her recording of John Newton's hymn became a top 40 hit. And then it seemed like everybody, black or white, rock or blues or country, wanted to put their own signature on the song.
Amazing grace, how sweet
the sound that saved
Judy Collins' recording of Amazing Grace was also a hit on British radio, which means that two centuries after Newton had penned it in England, where it never really caught on, it was finally finding an audience. This caught the ear of a bagpiper from the Royal Scots Dragoon Guards, who was inspired to give Collins' arrangement a Highlander feel. The Dragoon Guards' recording of Amazing Grace also became a major hit in England, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and South Africa. Collins liked hearing her arrangement on the bagpipes.
And I am thrilled that it has now permeated the police and firefighters.
For centuries, bagpipes have been an important part of Celtic funeral traditions. But the Dragoon Guards' recording sparked the tradition of piping Amazing Grace at memorials for police, firefighters, and military. It's certainly a tradition New Yorkers know well after the attacks on September 11th, 2001.
I can hear it. You know, I live on the Upper West Side, and about a block from me is the Firefighters Memorial on Riverside Drive. And so every once in a while, we hear the bagpipes coming up from the river, and we hear them playing Amazing Grace. And we see like 5,000 firefighters out there in the street with their uniforms. It's an amazing thing. It's very moving. And it's, of course, the appropriate place for this song to go. I mean, it belongs in these situations because it is regenerating the idea of hope and forgiveness.
Amazing grace, how sweet.
And after a mass shooting at a black church in Charleston, South Carolina, President Barack Obama offered the song's message of hope and forgiveness to the mourners.
A wretch like me.
Author Steve Turner
You know, Obama sings it at the church in Charleston after the murders, and you know, it's sung when policemen have funerals in New York. It just seems kind of like an all-purpose, hopeful song.
Barnard College professor James Basker says the song, both the musical notes and its lyrics, appeal to people at moments of intense suffering.
And they appeal without any narrowness. There's no specific condition, there's no specific religious faith, there's no specific cultural context. It's just about that thing that human beings share, which is pain. And the imaginative yearning, and this is the thing about human beings, we're able to imagine and to yearn for joy and peace, for relief from the miseries of this world. So it's the use of the human imagination, both the creative one that made the song and the receptive, interactive one that can identify with it, that lifts us up.
Amazing grace.
Throughout its history, Amazing Grace has spoken to Americans' belief in new beginnings and reinvention.
That's a very important part of the American mentality, you know, that you can start again, that you can come from nothing and succeed, and you can overcome a bad or dubious or hampering past. So all those things are in the song.
I want her.
You can feel as though you are lost. And somehow know that you'll be found.
But now
I'm found.
What you say, girl?
But now
I'm found.
We still can't feel you.
But now.
That was Trey Kay, host of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's podcast, Us and Them. That story originally aired on Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from PRI and WNYC. High-energy Christian services held outside are typically called tent revivals today. At the celebrations of faith, you still hear upbeat gospel hymns, the kind that inspired many American rock and roll artists. And you'll still see people dancing and clapping on the downbeat of the rhythms. To document some of the remaining services, Roger May started a project called Glory a few years ago. On May's personal website, rogermayphotography.com, one photograph shows a woman standing under a tent surrounded by women with arms outstretched while a man in a black suit has his hand on the woman's forehead. Another photograph shows a handmade sign that reads, Tent Revival, 7 p.m., sitting in front of a large bush. The photos are from tent revivals in eastern Kentucky and southern West Virginia. May recently sat down with me to talk about the photos.
I'm familiar with, you know, Pentecostal holiness movement, and grew up in a Free Will Baptist church, and have seen all manner of faith practices practiced here in the mountains. But I don't know that I'd ever been to a tent revival. I'd driven by and seen them before, but don't know that I'd ever been to one. And so when I pulled up in the parking lot, they had already started singing and playing music. And I sat there for a few minutes, and I watched a guy get up from under the tent and walk out and walk toward me. He introduced himself and asked me to come in and be a part of the service. And I said, well, I'm a photographer, and, you know, I've always wanted to photograph a tent revival. Would it be okay if maybe I made some pictures? And he kind of patted me on the arm and said, honey, you can take pictures of anything you want to. And if anybody has a problem with it, you just tell them to come see me. And I didn't know it at the time, but he was the preacher. And so I kind of felt like, you know, if he was giving me the green light to be there, then that was okay.
So you said you're familiar with sort of a Pentecostal-type religion in growing up, but you had never been to a tent revival. What have you learned about tent revivals?
I guess the takeaway for me has been just the persistence and the sheer faith of these folks, because there's nothing glorious about what they do. I mean, they're faithful servants. I mean, Brother Roger stays in a camper with his family, and there's no air conditioning. It's the summertime, and he's out for hours each evening preaching his sermon to an audience of, you know, maybe three people one night, maybe 30 people the next night. So I think there's something to be said about perseverance and being faithful to what you feel like you're called to do.
How important is it, do you think, to photograph tent revivals as far as depicting a part of Appalachia?
Well, for me, it's super important to me because I think it's something that's slowly dying off. It's a tradition that we don't see much of. You know, I was talking not long ago with someone about foot washing, you know, and I grew up in a church that, you know, they would wash feet, you know, on a fairly regular basis. And I think about those traditions that I know are still practiced, but they're maybe not known much outside of the region. And so I think tent revivals fall into that category of something that could be celebrated and should be preserved and shown in a way that that sort of embodies the dignity and respect that it deserves.
Why do you think that they have lasted as long as they have here?
I think it's the people. People like to gather, the element of faith. People gather around faith. There's an aspect of community that I've seen in West Virginia and Kentucky that I've never seen anywhere else. You know, there's that whole saying that, you know, you never meet a stranger, you know, and that's what I think about when I pulled into that parking lot and Brother Roger got up from under the tent and came out. I mean, as soon as I pulled up, he came out to meet me. And I don't know that I've been to too many other places that I can say somebody would do that.
But I think they might do that at like a beer fest too. Like they might come and greet you at that too. Do you think there's anything unique about the tent revivals or the people here that makes tent revivals last longer?
Faith. I mean, there's pretty strong faith, element of faith, and kind of walking out what it is that you feel called to do, I think is what was, you know, happening in that situation when he got up and came to my car and invited me in. I think that level of persistence and that commitment to faith is what drew him out to do that. And that's, I've got to believe that that's an underlying theme of why he's still, you know, doing tent revivals, you know, and people like to be a part of something bigger than themselves, you know, and whatever that is, whether it's faith or whether it's sports or, you know, this Looking at Appalachia project, I think, you know, we've had some success with that because people see that it's a community.
That was photographer Roger May talking about the photos he's taken of tent revivals in central Appalachia. Roger May is the director of the project called Looking at Appalachia. When that conversation was originally recorded back in 2017, May was also the director of the Appalachian South Folklife Center in Pipestem, West Virginia. He now lives in Charleston. You can find more about his projects on our website at wvpublic.org. Support for Inside Appalachia is provided in part by Stewart's Opera House, presenting the Nelsonville Music Festival in Nelsonville, Ohio from May 31st to June 3rd, featuring George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic, the Decemberists, Annie DeFranco, the Black Angels, and over 60 more acts on 5 stages over 4 days. Information at nelsonvillefest.org. Today we've been talking about religion and its influence on Appalachian culture and especially our music. For our final story, we hear the story about a musician who left his home in Fayette County, West Virginia, to work in the Nashville music industry for over 5 decades. His name is Charlie McCoy, and if you've listened to just about any album recorded in Nashville in the 1960s and 70s, chances are you've heard him. He played as a session musician for recording greats like Roy Orbison.
Wow, I was a huge fan of Roy Orbison. And we did the record Candyman. That was my second session, was Candyman, and when it hit the radio, my phone started ringing.
Yeah, come on, baby. Let me take you by the hand.
And Elvis Presley.
Elvis would sleep all day, and he wouldn't record until the night. They would bring in food at midnight, and one night we were in the line to get, they had burgers and fries, and the drummer named Jerry Kerrigan was, and there was a big milkshake cup full of dill pickle spears, and he reaches in to pull one of them out, and this hand out of nowhere grabs his wrist and said, "Those are Elvis's pickles." One of the Memphis Mafia.
Charlie McCoy also recorded albums with country greats like Loretta Lynn.
Ah, Loretta was so great. My favorite record that I played on with her was a ballad called When the Tingle Becomes a Chill.
Sometimes at night, while you're fast asleep, I lie here alone in the darkness and weep.
And he helped write one of George Jones's greatest hits, He Stopped Loving Her Today.
He stopped loving her today. It placed a wreath upon his door, and soon they'll carry him.
In 2017, Charlie McCoy published a book about his life story. His memoir is called 50 Cents and a Box Top. Where did the title come from? Roxy Todd explains.
Charlie McCoy was born in Oak Hill, West Virginia, the same town where they found the body of Hank Williams. Charlie was 8 years old when he got his first harmonica, the instrument that would later launch his career as a session musician in Nashville.
I saw an ad in a comic book. You can play harmonica in 7 days or your money back. Send 50 cents and a box top. And so I conned my mom out of 50 cents. You know, she was a single mom. In 1949, 50 cents was some money. It would buy something. But she bought this for me and felt like forever before it finally came. But when it did, after about a day, she said, could you take it outside? You know, an 8-year-old kid with a harmonica doesn't have a clue what he's doing, and I'm just making noise. And that's when I discovered that dogs and cats don't really care for harmonicas. All the neighborhood animals would protest as well.
He put that harmonica away for a few years. After all, he was more excited about playing baseball and guitar. But when he was in high school, he remembered his old harmonica again when he heard blues harmonica player Jimmy Reed playing on the radio.
The harmonica was so haunting the way he did it. Of course, I was a child of the 50s, you know, and rock and roll hit radio like a storm, you know. And one day while surfing the radio dial, I ran into a rhythm and blues station and I heard a record by Jimmy Reed. And when I heard that record with that harmonica, it hit me in the head. Hey, I got one of those. I need to learn to do that. So then I got reinterested in the harmonica in a big way.
By this time, Charlie had moved to Miami, Florida with his dad, who bought him an electric guitar and got him music lessons. In the Miami public schools, his music teachers recognized he had a special gift for learning music by ear.
The school system in Florida, they decided to experiment with music theory in the high school. It was classical theory, and the teacher, she was expert and knew how to teach it, and I was like a sponge. I couldn't get enough of it.
Then Charlie met a Nashville songwriter named Mel Tillis, who promised to help him get a contract with a record company if he ever made his way to Nashville.
That was like showing a steak to a wolf. And so the day after high school, I went to Nashville, and I went to the office of his manager, and they said, well, Mel's out of town.
But the publisher got Charlie an audition with Chet Atkins and Owen Bradley, who at that time were two of the major producers in Nashville.
And both of those guys turned Charlie down.
That's Travis Steimling, a music historian who co-wrote Charlie McCoy's book. Like Charlie, he's a West Virginia native. He now teaches at West Virginia University and directs the school's bluegrass band. And he's been a big fan of Charlie McCoy since he was a little kid, when he spent most Saturday nights watching Hee Haw. Charlie played on the show for 18 years and was the music director for most of them.
I remember during the summer especially, you know, we'd work in the garden late into the evening. Saturday nights, we would get a chance to go down to the house early, get a bath, and watch Hee Haw at 7 o'clock. And Charlie was the band leader on that. So I remember, you know, watching the opening credits, Charlie McCoy and the Hee Haw Band. And here's this guy in the back, you know, playing harmonica with everybody. And I thought, that guy's pretty cool. You know, I bet, you know, he must be a really great musician if everybody wants to play with him. And, you know, the more research I did, you know, as an adult, you know, fast forward 20 years or better, I realized that he really did play with everybody. You know, the reason he could play on Hee Haw with all of these great musicians is that he had recorded with them originally. He knew their work because he was one of the people who helped to make it.
And it all started that day in 1959 when 18-year-old Charlie was rejected by the two big recording producers in Nashville.
And of course, the best thing they did for me was turn me down as a singer.
But one of the producers invited him to see a recording session at his studio. 13-year-old Brenda Lee was recording this song called Sweet Nothings.
All right. My baby whispers in my ear.
And he gets to see Brenda Lee recording with a group of musicians that we call the Nashville A-Team. And it was there that he decided, this is so cool, I want to do it the rest of my life.
And when I watched that session and watched those musicians and then heard that first playback, at that moment I said, hey, I don't want to be a singer, I want to do this. That was my goal then, be a studio musician.
That story about Charlie McCoy originally aired in 2017. To hear the full story, head over to our website and listen to what happened once McCoy made his start in Nashville and what it was like to play with musicians like Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan. Find it at wvpublic.org. You know, music is a powerful thing in Appalachian culture, used to express many different things, passion, heartache, joy, and often our faith. Amazing Grace has helped me to say goodbye to so many different people in my life. I've heard and even sang it at many funerals, and after hearing the story in today's show, it brings on an even deeper meaning. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Studio 360, With Good Reason, and the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and the Looking at Appalachia Project. Music in today's show was provided by Judy Collins, Marisa Anderson, Dinosaur Burps, and Sister Rosetta Tharp. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.